dancing in the apocalypse.
I gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and sparkle, Neely, sparkle.
I know what some of your big city no bra wearing hairy legged women livers might say.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Maximum Film. We are on episode 210. It's your host, Ify Whiteyway, and of course, I'm in the booth with my friends. So let me introduce you to them. So first up, we have the Christmas Zaddy himself, formerly wearing a Christmas beanie, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
I put the beanie on because you're wearing a beanie for some unknown reason, but it's because
now I'm a
longshoreman.
So, longshoreman. Yeah,
course.
The bit came to me later.
Going theme,
like
I got
most
it.
Of my bits. Thought in the last second, executed poorly.
Only you could get another 20 minutes and suddenly it would all be right at the tip of your tongue.
I was like,
What's good for me is a new Netflix show called Q-Force. It is an animated spy comedy that is super, super, super gay. It is the product of a lot of talented people, including a friend of Maximum Fun, Guy Branum. And it is just sort of unapologetically silly and unapologetically queer. And I, as somebody who has lived in West Hollywood for more than 20 years, I have to say I really admire the attention to geographic detail from the placement of the Pacific Design Center, the Hamburger Mary's, Hugo's, not to mention the completely baffling parking signs. You know, this is the at one point they're tailing somebody and they say that he's going north south on San Vicente, which if you live here is funny. So I just, you know, I like that just complete immersion into the West Hollywoodness of it, even if that doesn't play to most of the country. But I dig it. I want more animated gay shenanigans on my TV, and this is a good place to start.
Ooh,
I feel like most people looking for a gay superhero show are definitely interested in what is the word? Topography.
There you go.
They are down for the specifics of landmarks. I'm only sort of kidding.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the writers and one of the voices on the show is friend of the show, Matt Rogers, who from Las Culturistas, who has been a guest in the past. And he's one of the lead characters, as is Wanda Sykes and Sean Hayes and David Harbour and the brilliant Patty Harrison.
Also, Ira Madison III as well.
And Ira, yes.
Oh. Yeah, we've casted the show.
Indeed. I know. Stop picking on our guests, Netflix, for Christ's sake.
Look, Netflix is going to hit your line tomorrow, Moshe. Or they just be ready for that.
Oh, you don't do a fanfare thing? I'm here.
No,
you're not
interested. He was doing a preemptive drip drop.
Trying to hold back on my riffs over here because I didn't want to break the fourth wall.
You will get the full red carpet, I assure you.
Yeah, we double dutch around here because we can't shut up. Speaking of
the riff I was going to do the riff. Also, a voice on the show, friend of the show, Ben Shapiro.
Yes.
Nobody saw that coming, but
neither his presence on the show nor this podcast. Real twist all around. Yeah, yeah.
He's never been a guest on the show. He's a shadow friend of the show.
Big fan.
Oh, he bought a lot of pins.
Also up, fellow cat parent, fellow cutie and queen of the Midwest, who tries to deny it, but that's what a queen of the Midwest would do. Drea Clark, what's good?
Me at the zip code I've lived in for 20 years try and deny it. But yeah, first off, don't think I didn't hear that you almost segued into me with, speaking of can't shut up, I heard that, Ify. I know your brain.
I don't recall.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall.
It was right there.
It was. Wow.
What is good with me is Penelope Spheeris. I adore Penelope Spheeris. I am happy to brag that I am friends with Penelope Spheeris. She's the director of a fantastic trilogy of documentaries, The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 1, 2, and 3. If you have any interest in punk rock or metal or gutter punks and 90s punk, these are the movies for you. They are currently on Canopy. I highly recommend them. And she's also has some weird, dark movies from the 90s, like Dudes and Boys Next Door and Suburbia. And then fare that you may know, more like Wayne's World and the Beverly Hillbillies and Little Rascals. So Penelope Spheeris is being honored this weekend at the Skyline Indie Film Fest in Virginia. And I was lucky enough to have a conversation with her for the opening night film where they're showing Decline of Western Civilization. And then I'm also taking part in, what am I doing? Friday night, we are doing a live read of Wayne's World. And because I am not an actor, I will be playing assorted random ass background characters that have one line, which is my specialty. And then on Saturday, we're doing a live show. And these will also extend on, if you don't see them live, of Screen Drafts. We're drafting Penelope's top seven films. I'm doing that with critic Simon Abrams. So if you love Penelope Spheris or my annoying ass voice and you want to support this small ass festival in Virginia, a lot of this, actually all of these elements are going to be virtual. So yeah, check out Skyline Indie Film Fest and soak it up and then just watch Penelope shit. Like watch Dudes. The woman made a punk rock Western with John Cryer and Daniel Roebuck. I mean,
The role of music store employee who points at the No Stairway sign will be played by Drea Clark.
No stairway. Denied.
That will truly be me. That's where I excel.
Speaking of must watch and comics to watch, this is a comedian who can be heard on the podcast Endless Honeymoon and has a special on Netflix, The Honeymoon Stand-Up Special. My boy, we've known each other for quite some time. Moshe Katcher, how you doing?
I'm fantastic. You know, I've done a live reading of Wayne's World, actually. What are the odds of that? Two people on one podcast doing a live reading. And you know who else was on that live reading? None other than Tia Carrere herself.
No. Ooh, wow. I met her once. She presented at an award show that I was working, and she was so lovely and so beautiful. And I'm sure it was just wonderful as herself. In your live reading.
Well, yeah, we weren't, to be honest, we weren't worthy.
Oh, nice. Landed that. Yeah.
No, she mixed it up. She read the Lara Flynn Boyle role. That's
right. what's good? I'm supposed to tell you what's good. Is that right?
What is good?
I mean, if we're plugging things we're going to be doing, I think if Delta doesn't decimate, well, first of all, I want to say what's good is that the truth about ivermectin is getting out to the people and that it's a way to heal yourself without an experimental vaccine. Just kidding, everybody. I don't believe that. But if Delta doesn't destroy it, I am tentatively scheduled to do a live stand-up show in Phoenix, Arizona at the Copper Blues the first weekend in October. But that might not happen. We'll see what happens. But I'll tell you what's good. I went to fake canceled Burning Man this last weekend. And that was really weird and really good. It was good.
Which parking lot did they have it in?
It was in the place where it usually is, but with official sanction, just a bunch of like hyper-motivated, dirt hippies that decided they weren't going to take no for an answer. And in the end, it wasn't a complete clusterfuck. It was pretty fun. It reminded me of, I started going in the 90s, and 96 was my first year when I was 16. And it reminded me of what it was like in the 90s if Burning Man had evolved not from the weird cypherpunk culture jamming cacophony society weirdos of the 80s that it evolved from, but rather if it had evolved from contemporary Burning Man culture. So it was like the punk rock version of Burning Man, only derived from the really commercial techno-fueled version of Burning. Does that make any sense?
It's weirdly, like when people put out cover albums of themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The problem was there's no traffic regulations, and the desert where Burning Man takes place is where they conduct land speed trials for super fast cars. And so people were, going 80 in like 1972, like Toyota RVs across the playa. And I have a daughter, and my daughter needs her dad. She needs that. She, even though it would probably turn her into an interesting artist if I died when she was 3.5. I told my friends, I was like, you got to park your cars around my RV as a kind of, a
buffer,
a wall. Yeah. Buffer. I was like, your Dodge is
literally had them circle the wagons.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I just thought, your insurance will take care of your truck, but who's going to take care of my child? So
yeah,
maybe you're asking yourselves, if you're such a concerned father, what were you doing at fake Burning Man in the first place? I don't have an answer for that.
Look, as a father myself, you don't want your kid to be a fucking dork. So you gotta take him to cool place. That's my biggest worry, is a dork ass kid coming up to me asking me about some homework. Go do drugs.
Yeah. Definitely his biggest worry.
And you're so cool, Liffy.
No, I have a genuine anxiety about that. Iffy, maybe you're being, I know you're doing a bit, but maybe there's some truth to it too. I have a genuine anxiety. What am I supposed to tell my kid about, we're not there yet, about drugs and sex and everything else? Because it's like, on the one hand, I want her to be like, never get in any trouble and always be safe and always have like the most peaceful. But on the other hand, those are the foundational experiences of my young life that created the kind of weirdo that I am today. I don't want to have the conversation at all. I want to run.
Yeah, I know. For me, sex, I'm a... totally super explain it, because as someone who like grew up in both Catholic and public school, the kids who like knew about sex knew what they were doing. And even though they're like, your kids are good, I think the fact of the matter is, if we just remember how we were, they're gonna bang either way. So the all I gotta do is just make sure they have the right information. I'm gonna try and be the dad who's like, don't be smoking that wacky tobacco, and just hope that she's good at hiding it from me.
I'll tell you who doesn't bang in high school, if it's the dorky kid. So I think you may be having this entirely. Yeah.
Keep them listening to this podcast.
Iffy, do you have anything good other than how excited you are to talk about sex with your child?
Oh, man. Well, how excited I am to see this child react to this cat. I have rescued a cat. It's a Siamese little limpy girl named Puar after a Dragon Ball Z character, because, of course. Yeah. And it's been nice, because it's like a very like chill cat. Like, it's not trying to jump on anything. Like, it only wants to be in a lap or sitting next to you. So it's the perfect cat for me. Like, I was in the room for Grand Cru today, and it was just sitting right next to me on the desk, like not trying to walk on the keyboards, just want to stare and make sure that I'm not going to leave her.
Dude, so, you got a purebred rescue? That's rare.
Yeah.
No, he got the bougiest rescue cat I've ever seen.
Cool though, you get woke points and style points in the same cat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, best of both worlds.
Can we also do a quick general shout out? What's good of the election, the re-election, recall election's not good, but voting in the recall election in California is good.
Please do.
And so, if you're listening to this when it comes out, I think you have like a week left. Everyone was registered. Like, everyone got a mail vote or mail ballot. The word I'm looking for. A mail-in ballot for this. Please drop them off. Just put no. And then I also researched like who the highest trending Democrat was at that point. But I think that the the Secretary of State listed the names of who is registered for the write-in. But anyway, vote. Please, thank you. Please. That's all.
Yes. Wait, before we move on, Iffy, I wanted to tell you, you said the public school kids know a lot about sex. This is not true. When I was in public school exclusively, and when condoms first started, you know, the big push around the early 90s, there was a push to get condoms in everybody's minds. I remember the kids in my class, I think it was probably fourth grade, the like cool suave kids would come up to me and be like, come up to us and go, hey, I'm wearing one right now. It's like, you don't know how these work.
Oh my God. The exact brand of who I would have crushed on at that age is the idiot that would wear a condom.
That's what makes me mad, is just knowing that I would have been the kid that was like, that guy's tight.
Literally.
Yes. He's not comfortable. Oh, yeah.
Well, let's get this show on the road today. We're discussing Coda, and of course we'll answer a question from the hotline, and as always we'll have staff picks. But first, it's time for our new segment, Itadic, short for Is This Important, Do I Care. Each of us will read a new segment and answer the question, Is This Important, Do I Care. Patty Jenkins says that streaming films look like fake movies to me. Last week, Wonder Woman director Patty Jenkins spoke at the CinemaCon luncheon in Las Vegas and voiced her dissatisfaction with Warner Brothers' decision to release Wonder Woman 1984 in theaters and on HBO Max the same day. She called that decision detrimental to the movie because she doesn't think it plays the same on streaming. But this week, more quotes have leaked from CinemaCon as reported by the LA Times. Apparently, Jenkins also does not appreciate that Wonder Woman 1984 was made immediately available on streaming because of her opinion of streaming-only films. Here's what she had to say about that. All of the films that streaming service are putting out, I'm sorry, they look like fake movies to me. I don't hear about them. I don't read about them. It's not working as a model for establishing legendary greatness, end quote. Is this important? Do you care?
To paraphrase broadcast news, it takes real courage to talk like that in front of a room full of theater managers and owners. Like,
yeah.
CinemaCon is a thing that used to be called Show West. It's where all the exhibitors get together and they find out about, like, the latest nacho cheese technology. And they get to see the, you know, they get sold whatever the next year's movies are going to be. So, obviously, this is a room full of harried, unhappy people who've just come off a really terrible year where they were probably closed for a long time. They've had to, like, you know, completely have to train their underpaid staff to, you know, wipe every single surface down all the time to make people feel better about the pandemic. And so, of course, Patty Jenkins is going to tell them, what? Streaming? Pah! Get a horse, you know? She was totally playing the room. I can't believe that she believes that that is true. I think that, you know, Roma and the Irishman would like a word, frankly, not to mention I'm thinking of ending things. So I think that it's ridiculous, and I think she knows it's ridiculous, and I think she was just saying that because, again, she was talking to a room full of Regal and AMC bigwigs.
Also, I think, like, it was the internet, film Twitter was taking it as she was talking about the quality of the movies. And I think she just means that they don't get as much press and they just kind of come and go so that they're just like there. Once again, yeah, this probably was a work so that they can keep, so the theater people can go, yes, we are important. But it was, you know, interesting how, like, I don't even want to say film Twitter. I want to say mostly, like, superhero movie nerd Twitter wanted to use this as a way to bash Patty Jenkins and be like, you made this movie, Roma is great. And I was like, yeah, I don't think she was saying that, bro. I think you just wanted another shot to take shots at Patty Jenkins, which you should investigate that, because, I mean, you got Snyder standing right there. Yeah, he's right there. He's waiting for you.
I think that she's probably fairly enough salty about her release because Warner Brothers made a lot of those calls without consulting the filmmakers. So there's kind of an artistic neglect there and a disrespect and whatever else, not to mention whatever money she might feel like she lost out on in having this sort of day and date release. I know it's come up with other things. I agree with Iffy. To me, her quote read more, and it's valid, the idea of how many things come out on Netflix or on Amazon. We talked last week when we talked about Annette, which was this huge movie in the film world and had played Cannes and was all these places. And not only was it not on the homepage of Amazon, I had to, like, search for, I had to type it in. I couldn't even scroll and find it. So I understand the idea of they lose the marketing, they lose all sorts of things. But the other thing is she makes big ass movies these days, and everything she has lined up is also big ass, big budget, big effects. And those things do look good on a big screen. Ooh, I used the word big three times. Rule three. Yeah, yeah. It's very proud.
I'm assuming that her deal with Warner Brothers was better than a lot of other people's, just because that was sort of she was the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like all of the 2021 movies, like they had to actually sit down with and be like, okay, yeah, here's where we are and theaters aren't. Could we just, what if we did this? So I'm sure she had a much more fruitful conversation with them than, you know, Denis Villeneuve about Dune, let's say, you know, or any other movie that is getting the day and date treatment from them this year.
Yeah, well, guess what, guys? Francois Truffaut saw Wonder Woman 1984 and he said that didn't seem like a real film to him. Boom! No, I'm just kidding. I don't care. This feels like a don't care to me.
Oh my God, I'm super psyched by the Truffaut reference that I didn't see coming.
Well, I had a long time. While you guys were actually using real information to talk about the movie industry, I was just over here churning on what's a good, what's a,
See, you could have gone with Godard, who's actually alive, but either way, it's still good.
Okay. Well, no, it's even more mystical this way.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah,
I appreciate that. He came back
just to talk about Wonder Woman.
And the ghost of Truffaut is back among us.
So... we do have a couple of real sad monster It Addicts segments to discuss today. The first one is that actor Michael K. Williams died this past week. Williams is best known for his role as Omar Little on The Wire. He was also memorably featured in 12 Years a Slave, Boardwalk Empire, most recently Lovecraft Country. This isn't written in here, but... he was also a dancer and choreographer. And if you look up Crystal Waters, 100% Pure Love, he is the figure dancing in the middle. And please watch it. And then also that song will be stuck in your head for 18 years. You're welcome.
And he choreographed that video.
And he choreographed it, yes. So Michael K. Williams passed away. Is this important? Do you care?
Very. And very tragic. And, you know, a thing that I haven't really heard discussed a lot, but like he played some really important queer characters in his filmography, and ones who I think obviously when you cast Michael K. Williams as that character, you are standing up against any number of paradigms about how queer characters are usually presented in the culture. So, you know, certainly on The Wire, but also most recently in Lovecraft Country, you know, he brings a real edge to the material. But he was just one of those guys who, like, you saw his name in the credits and you knew that part of the movie or the TV show was going to be great because he always nailed it.
Totally agree. I mean, one of those people with the gravitational pull, like he had both gravity and gravitas, you know?
Yes.
I totally agree. There's something about him that was every time he was on, your eyes were locked on him. Cool guy, very sad. And drugs right now are very scary. I feel like there's, I don't know if, not to make this too societally large, but it does feel like there's something bad happening in the drug supply chain in America right now that is really, really scary. I don't know what happened with Michael K. Williams, but in town recently, there was a group of comedians that were doing fentanyl-laced coke, and three of them died, and one's in the hospital. Right. And it just feels like it's a scary time to be doing white powders, so be careful, everyone. Test your shit.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I want to say I like that you said that, but like I don't obviously like the subject. But I think there's a lot of like around this subject, everyone wants to be like, don't do drugs, don't do that. Like that doesn't address addiction. That doesn't address what people actually go through. So I think what Moshe said is very important. If you are going to use safely, test. There's testing kits, and please take care of yourself.
And revisit his work. I mean, it's a hit for our art form that we love so much. I think that Alonzo's right in terms of the unique avenue into queer characters that he had. Omar Little stands alone. Like, there's no other character you can think of like that. And that he brought such authenticity to it and such cool. I mean, just him as an actor, he's one of those people you never saw the edges of what he was doing. He was just fully in that. And you were like, man, they're lucky they found this actual drug dealer who just said the right things at the right time. Like, he just has that. In Boardwalk Empire, like Chalky White, I found the same thing. And that's a period piece. Like, anyway, please look back at his work and...
you know what's
enjoy
cool
it.
About Omar? I mean, Omar Little is one of the great characters on TV ever, obviously. And everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people saw it as this revolutionary character. And Moonlight had a similar vibe to it of like this hyper-masculine and yet queer. And yet was based on sort of homophobic expectations of what queer people and characters should be. But also, it's to me, like... one of my childhood friends is a hyper masculine guy that came out to me when he was, you know, we were 20, and I was like stuck in this, like, I had no idea because of my expectations about what it meant to be masculine and to be a black man in the world, whatever, whatever. So to me, it was not only this really revolutionary character, but this really hyper true character to humanity and people at large. So like revolutionary in more than one ways, not just because it blew everybody's mind, but also because it was very, in a way, ordinary. His character was very much not ordinary. He was a superhero, and all the hyper-violence was the least believable part of Omar Little's character. But the sexuality and masculinity combination, I thought, was like, that was both revolutionary, but also like very familiar and very real.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about Coda.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week on Bullseye, David Byrne on the Talking Heads easing back into live performance and the magic of doo-wop.
You don't get it very much, people doing dippity-dip-dip, whoa-whoa, you don't get a lot of that.
Listen to Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Storyblocks makes it possible for creators to keep up with the growing demands for modern video content. So you can bring all your stories to life and stop sacrificing your vision due to time, budget, or resources.
Storyblocks Unlimited All Access plan gives you unlimited downloads of more than 1 million assets in their library. You can try out multiple options quickly and find the perfect fit so you can create more and spend less. Restock is their commitment to increase representation in stock media by hiring creators from marginalized communities to create content that is more reflective of the diverse world in which we live. Stay on budget while telling the best version of your story with the most affordable subscription plans and tools on the market that scale to meet your needs.
All right, fellas. So putting this all in play, then when they say 1 million plus assets in their library, they don't just mean photos. They don't just mean video. It also means things like templates for lower thirds, just sexy stuff like when you're titling or you want things to just have a more professional gleam to them. So if you are shooting something and you, and I said fellas, by the way, addressing Alonzo and Iffy, I don't know who's listening to this. You can be whatever you want and I'll dress you like that. But if you are shooting something and you want it to look polished, you want to flesh out by adding background shots or B-roll, things that you couldn't afford to shoot yourself to really expand the world of what you're doing, Storyblocks is your way to find those things. So if you are interested in checking them out, you can explore their library and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/maxfilm. That's storyblocks.com/MAXFILM.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Moshe Kasher.
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today we're talking about Coda. Drea, would you mind providing us a bolded, brief synopsis?
Yeah, I'll keep it brief. Got your synopsis right here, Casey. Okay, Coda is a movie centered around a 17-year-old girl who's a senior in high school. She's the only hearing member of a deaf family. Both her parents and her brother are deaf, and they live in a very small town in Massachusetts that's completely centered around the fishing business. They have a fishing boat themselves that her dad runs. She and her brother both work on it, and her true love at school is choir, and she wants to be a singer. And of course, it's set up the sort of uniqueness of having a passion that the members of your family are unable to appreciate to the same degree as other people, and all of the conflict that might come with that. She also has a little love story. She has a relationship with her choir teacher, a good one, not a creepy one. The phrase relationship with her choir teacher automatically sounds creepy, and I didn't mean that. Yes, so it is a movie about a young woman living a very specific life. Coda.
So, you know, I think I'll kick this off with a quote. Deaf writer Sarah Novick said Coda in USA Today, "I like that these characters were sexual beings. Deaf and disabled people are often neutered or virginal in movies and books, and that's extremely boring and inaccurate." And I want to touch on the fact that we also touched on this with Crip Camp too, of just how when we put on safety gloves when we touch these topics in cinema, and we want to and in the end it's just such a disservice. So what do you think about the representation of deaf people in that way in this film?
I love that we found the horniest fishing village. And also that not just that the representation of, I had a thing of, are they going to explain to me, are these deaf people more horny than everyone else around them? Is that part of what makes this particular family tick? Because it's really built in so nicely. But yeah, that was a detail.
Or what, yeah. Drea? Or are deaf people just more horny than everybody else?
Yeah, that was the main question I wanted answered by Coda.
Another deaf couple who are not as horny just for balance?
That's what I was like, is there going to be the counterbalance? Like, let's explore this more. Let's move from this choir. I just want to get into these sex lives. This is good stuff.
I had little feeling about the representation of sexuality of the deaf characters because I am a product of the sexuality and horniness of deaf characters. I've heard many, too many deaf people having sex in my day, and all of them were my mother. So.
That's actually the first stand-up I saw of yours, Moshe, was you were doing... this was a while ago. You were doing a set, I don't know comedian lingo, but about
a tight 10.
We like to call it a little skit.
A little skit.
Doing about, a little skit.
About your deaf mother and funny stuff with that. Yeah. Yeah. The family's in this, and this is something too. The name Coda stands for child of deaf adult or deaf adult. Anyway.
Child,
you can have more than one, but yes, you know what I'm saying. But it also, to me, if you are friends with anyone in treatment or the program, it's Codependence Anonymous. And I actually found that to be a really unexpected thread and something that I quite liked, because one of the things that's set up about this film and is always set up whenever we talk about films like this that have some kind of representational angle that therefore makes them the one film that speaks for all of the people within that community, and how unfair that is to the filmmakers and the artists making that, and also to those communities that you're like, I get one shot at representation and it's this fucking fishing movie. But like with this, I appreciated that the whole idea of that. When I saw Coda and thought of codependence, that is actually kind of it. It's not just that this family with the mother and the father who are super horny, it's that they've set up the structure of their family in a way very specific to them, very internal, very codependent. And it's that and how that translates into a reliance on their daughter to be their interpreter. I liked the specificity that it's because of how this family is set up and not all families with deaf members have such a strong need for the one person. I could be completely wrong, but for me, I liked that there felt like a shade of acknowledging that it was specific to this story.
I felt that too when it came to the stuff with the boats and where they were kind of confronted with that. It's such a it was such a unique issue to this family that it was able to kind of make it where it did take it off, where it's like, oh no, this is this family's problem. This is what they're dealing with. And also what I like too is because, you know, there's a version of this story where there's the one side where it's like, oh man, look how tough it is for this person to be dependent on it. But it also flips it with her brother, who's like, we're not dumb. We don't like, you don't need to coddle us. And you almost get this conversation of both sides of like her end, where she feels like, oh, y'all need me too much. And you need the brothers end, where it's like, well, also you're kind of stepping in all the time anyway, and you should chill.
Importantly, the brother is just as horny as the parents.
Oh yeah, no,
I think it's good for us.
I related
to
the parents and the brother. I was
actually
like, this
the
is
hearing
this
girl character. Ruby is the least, seemingly the least horny of the entire cast. You know, and it just goes to show you the old adage is true: hearing people are not as horny as the deaf.
Like a tail is all this like time.
Thing, is this the thing where you lose one sense and then all the other ones get enhanced? Right. Is
that like Daredevil of sexuality.
Bingo.
I mean, Drea, I want to both acknowledge, I should say to your listeners, I am a Coda. My parents are both deaf. All of my family on my father's side are deaf. My mother is also deaf, but my father remarried after my parents split, and the woman, he's now dead, so he's no longer deaf. He can hear me from heaven, and he's listening to this podcast. But the woman that he married had very strong genetic deafness. And so all of their kids are deaf. My stepsister is deaf. All of my nieces and nephews on that side of the family are deaf. All of the cousins on that side of the family are deaf. So I have deafness doesn't run in my family. It gallops. And I would say that it's both true what you're saying. It's not total bullshit what you're saying. And I think that the codependent coda thing is, if I had to guess what Sean was thinking, naming it coda, I would guess it's an unintended double entendre. And I think that's as you know, every art historian will say, like, the power of great art is that you can find these things, and maybe even the creator didn't intend.
It's a movie about fishermen. It's actually Cod A.
Oh, it's my A grade God. Cod. That's what? Right. It's the top.
But I would say, yes, every deaf family is different. Yes, every deaf person is different. But it is a very common and familiar theme of the Coda's life that they are, to one degree or another, even in my family, and my parents were pretty sophisticated, to one degree or another, you do always take on the role in some way of the interpreter, the cultural interlocutor, the person that's defending your parent, even when they don't want that defense, even when they're not even asking for it. That is a part of the weird role that is being a coda and is being born into a deaf family, especially when you're the only hearing person in that family. Because they were pretty culturally isolated too. They barely touched on it, but there's a line in there where she's like, you don't even see your deaf friends anymore. So it's truly like a small town, a small family, and one hearing person to kind of play that role. And it's a messy and complicated role because deaf people are adults with you know, sophisticated cognition and their own hopes and dreams and desires, and yet so sometimes you're being too much in that role of protector and you're not wanted in any way, and sometimes they're relying on you in ways that are unfair to you. And I thought that they did a pretty good job of translating that kind of messiness. I mean, me watching it, you know, I'm seeing things that not nobody else but very few people are seeing, and seeing things that both ring really true that I think probably most viewers missed, and seeing things that don't quite ring true that also most people just miss. But anyway, I think that...
I appreciate you bringing up that line, because I think that's one of the many... You know, obviously, this is this family where a lot of the times they're having communication in ASL, in sign language, and they do not subtitle this film. So you are watching these long scenes where you are gleaning the communication as best you can, and, you know, sort of the flip-flop irony.
Some of the conversations are subtitled.
Oh, I didn't. I might have had my subtitles off.
Are you serious?
In fact, the entire film is subtitled. Yeah.
No, I watched it with no subtitles.
Oh, this is where we find out that you don't know what the movie's about.
You guys. And then there's like a drug cartel, right? People come and hold hostage.
That's not like, there was a Hungarian, there was some Eastern European film a few years ago that was all in sign language with zero subtitles.
I 100% watched this with no subtitles.
Oh, wow.
And it made total sense to me.
Well,
and I
you.
Actually got so much out of those scenes. That's why I thought it was an artistic choice. I knew that the director, she had talked about wanting to, and when they did their theatrical, they had made sure it only played places where they not only had subtitles, but there's a different kind of subtitle that you have for a deaf community that's like a more, anyway. So I was like, oh, she did a whole thing where she did the theatrical, but in the, oh my God.
Cool. You're going to have to rewatch this.
Stop down and come back and re-record this episode in a week.
Let me say this.
Speaking of, and interestingly, Drea, you probably got this more than most viewers, because I and other people that are like me, I guess, that are, that, well, actually, anybody reading the subtitles who knows ASL watching, but my primary, my headline on all this is, if Troy Kotsur doesn't get an Academy Award nomination, there is no justice in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, Marley is a friend and obviously a national treasure and was so great. But Troy, what do they say in the movie industry? A revelation. I mean, I got this particularly advantageous position to see, reading the subtitles, which did exist, Rhea, what the line in English that he was working with, and then watching in the ASL translation that he chose to go with. This would have been maybe missed. You might have been able to kind of ambiently sort of get it, but the ASL he was using was so poetic and evocative and imagery based. There's one line in particular that I remember. There's a line in the script when he's fighting with his son about setting up a co-op, because that's part of another co-op. they're trying to set up a fishery co-op with all the fishermen, and the deaf son is saying, why don't we just start this ourselves? And the line is something like, you know, they're not going to let us set it up. You know, we're the deaf guys. They all laugh at us. Mm-hmm. And the sign that he chose to say, there's a lot that he did. But what he chose to translate that line of, we're just the deaf guys, they all laugh at us, was essentially, you know, we're all deaf. And then he does this crazy, like, farmer's sneeze. Like, you watching might think that that's the sign for laugh at us, but it's not. He translated it into, they all look at us and they blow a farmer's sneeze upon us. He does a literal act out of a farmer's sneeze, like, as if, we're scum, we're nothing to them, and they spit, you know, they spray their snot on us because that's how much they think of us. Now, that's a very high level translation. It's not literally a translation of the line, they all laugh at us. It's an interpretation, which is really what a great sign language interpreter is called interpreter because of that, because you can translate, but in real ASL, it's more of an interpretation.
Well, see, you preemptively answered a question I was going to ask, and I'm so glad we landed on that, because there were moments where I was like, based on the little ASL that I, you know, have picked on up on a past, I'm like, this seems like a lot longer for what they're saying. And that totally explains why that's happening. And that makes it, to me, wonderful that there's this, like, it almost is like a love letter to someone who understands ASL watching, that they get like another layer of the story, which is tight.
But there is something about that, of when you're learning about it as a language, the idea that it's, because the performance of it's so true. And Troy Kotsur, who plays the father of this family, is such an incredible actor. Again, talk about someone who looks like he literally just rolled off a fishing boat and they happened to be lucky enough to find him. And he is so immersed in it and is so like body and sexy and just like into his hot wife, and you know, like just this really rich kind of Shakespearean character. But how he is acting and how that combines with his language, and it's also this thing, if you watch people speak with ASL, so much of it is what your face is doing. It's the emotional and like just the what's the word I'm looking at? It's like the punctuation of what your face is doing. And like, if those are actors' tools anyway, and he is versed in a language that takes such advantage of that, like, it gives you this amazing performance.
Well, yeah, I mean, watching him and Marley too, but really my eyes were on him a lot of the movie. You said the word rich. That's what he was using. He was using an ASL register that was so rich and with such depth, but also not obviously high class. You know, there is such a thing as a fancier version of ASL that is a more similar analog to spoken language. You know, you hear BBC English what you were watching was sort of, I guess this is a good analogy, BBC English or the Queen's English is one thing, but watching a person like with a rich kind of Cockney, but a poet in that sort of Cockney brogue, that's kind of what it was like watching Troy. And then there's a scene that I think everybody, I won't spoil it, but everybody will know when they watch it, where Troy switches from being this really kind of wild, almost comedic character to there's a really, really powerful emotional scene. And that was when I was like, you know those moments in movies where you're like, oh, this motherfucker needs an Oscar. Like, that was that moment right there where I was like, okay, are you okay? You deserve this.
Wait, Alonzo, I feel like you were trying to say something, and I got so excited to talk more about Troy that I cut you off.
No, I was going to save it for the scoring, although I will say that as somebody who speaks Spanish, just that the experience of like watching, say, women on the verge of a nervous breakdown, when you hear the rather florid string of obscenities that get turned into a somewhat flatter English version, I think that's a commonality of knowing the language that the movie is being made in, and then like the subtitles never don't always quite grasp, you know, all of the intricacies and the delicacies of what's being, you know, presented by the actors.
I mean, that's why you should just turn the subtitles off.
And this isn't a critique. I really enjoyed the movie. It would be hard for me not. Well, no, it wouldn't have been hard for me not to enjoy it because it's pretty. It's pretty.
You'd be the first to know if they'd gotten something wrong.
Yeah, and not everything was 100%. I mean, listen. Anytime you have an actor who is literally learning ASL for the role, you will know that you are not dealing with a native ASL speaker. That said, Emilia Jones does an incredibly admirable job with the level of ASL register that she got to. I was very impressed, though I would never mistake her for a native speaker. I was still like, this is probably the hardest anyone's ever nailed, this particular bizarre social experiment of casting, hearing people that aren't ASL fluent in a role like this. I think, though, this isn't a critique, but I think this is a movie about deafness for hearing people. And a lot of movies about deafness are for hearing people. I mean, it's not lost on me that the penultimate thematic point of this is music, and I thought Sean, who is a fantastic director, and I've worked with her, and she's a great writer too, and did a great job of showing the kind of, you know, what the parents are dealing with is this very intriguing subject of trying to care about something that is like, you know, lost on them. Not that they don't know that music exists, but you can't really grok what music is if you've never even heard it or touched it. Trying to stay, allowing their love for her to supersede their kind of disinterest in what she's doing. I thought the scene where they're watching her sing, I won't again spoil what happened director wise, but I thought it did a pretty good job of just like, you know, of showing that this is something that isn't their world. So I thought that it was true. This was a movie about deafness for hearing people, as a lot of movies about deafness are, The Sound of Metal included. But in that said, I did cry. I don't like to admit that, but I got all emotional and I did enjoy it.
All right. So for our final review, would you screen it, stream it, or skip it?
I'll go first.
Yeah.
As the person who loves to follow instructions, unless those instructions are turning your subtitles on. this for me would be a screen it, largely because I very much enjoyed it. I thought that she was juggling, you know, some really interesting disparate threads narratively and giving us this subculture that we don't often, actually a couple of subcultures you don't often see in movies. Also with the sort of socioeconomic and the industry that we were seeing. And the other thing, it is very difficult to make a movie this earnest. And I say that as like an uncool person who's comfortable with earnestness. This movie is not trying to like give you a wink. It is not trying to like, ooh, here's the cool, gritty side of, no, it is earnest and charming and happy to be those things. And just like, it just lets that wash over it. And I can respond to things like that. I know some people have blocks against it. Maybe people who want to be cooler than I am. But I think that for handling all of those, it did it so well. And I knew every beat that was coming and I still bawled like four times. There were like still four times where I was like, I know what scene's going to come next. And it did. And I was like, that worked. That worked for me. So yeah, screen it for me.
Well, I mean, look, I think absolutely, not only am I friends and a coworker, a former coworker of the director, and friends with Marley, and gave notes on the script and So I want people to see this, and it's about my life, the world that I live in. I want people to see the movie. But I think you're right, Drea. Like, it was a very earnest film, and I thought that any time that it would even come close to being too earnest, the power of the performances would ground it and pull it. And just to see Troy, and honestly, the whole cast, but really Troy and Amelia do their thing. But really Troy, I mean, to me, that was the guy that I'm obsessed with this guy now. Screen It is the best thing? Screen yeah. it. Hey, Screen It.
Nice. All right.
I'm a Stream It because this movie pulls me in two directions. On the one hand, I love the cultural specificity. I love the intricacies and the details of lives that we don't see portrayed in movies often enough. I love the performances. I love a lot of what this movie is bringing to the table. At the same time, I feel like I've seen this plot before with variations. This is Real Women Have Curves. This is the special high school senior and the one teacher who sees the thing in her, who's going to help her get that scholarship so she can leave the town behind. But does she want to leave the town behind? You know, all that jazz. Like, we've seen that a lot. And also, I wish this movie weren't trying so hard to be the feel good film of the year, because I think it paints itself into corners where it does things that make zero sense, only to set up later scenes that are out to like pull every nose hair out to make sure that you are crying by the end of it. And that got on my nerves because so much of it is so smart and it's so good. I hated that it was also pandering to me, and I wish it had trusted itself to follow the interesting new different threads and take us to somewhere interesting rather than pile on the sort of familiar stuff just to make sure we were still not going to leave the theater because ew, deaf people. So I'm a Stream It.
It sounds like you are not as horny as a deaf person. No, I mean, that's just my reaction to what you're saying right now. Maybe it was a lack of horniness that was you were unable to get past that.
Always a possibility.
So it's so funny because one of the things you said, Alonzo, is a thing I'm a dead ass sucker for, which is like a teacher who like never gives up. You know, shout out to Mr. Belikoff in middle school who told me I can write, and you know, that you know, now you see where it led me. So yeah, I had a real fun time, and of course, horniness always a plus. Horny God approved, loved it. And also, yeah, it is like that is something I immediately clocked in that scene where the parents hook up was like, yeah, we fucking, like, you know, it's not so all about that. Good ride. Also, the reason I want to say Screen It too is like there were a lot of beautiful shots on the sea, and I'm a sucker. I like seeing water move. I love cruises, and like that opening shot was so just gorgeous, and the water blue crashing waves, and I was all the way locked in, and I remember all I was thinking while I was rocking on that boat is, I hope this movie's horny. So it's a screen it's a screener for me. Shout out. You know, I hope I can't wait to see what's next.
You know, one thing we didn't mention, I think that is worth mentioning, is for as feel-good movie of the year as it often was in points, it was also, there were genuinely funny parts to it. There were really, the bits and the scenes really worked comedically and were just straight up really funny. And I love that when I see these worlds combine, my two worlds, which are deafness and comedy, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Deaf comedy?
The Deaf Comedy Jam.
A jam.
Yeah.
If I could mix those two things into some kind of a preserve, then my life would be really good.
A marmalade.
Perfect. Yeah, Deaf Comedy Marmalade.
We did it. We mission accomplished. We saw the assignment and we did it. So now we'll take a break. We'll take a break and we'll be right back after these voices you hear talking about stuff.
Let's take a break.
Hey, podcast fan. We'd like to get a better idea of who you are and what you care about. So we have a quick favor to ask. If you have a few minutes to spare, please go to MaximumFun.org/adsurvey. There, we've got a short anonymous survey that will take about 5 minutes to fill out. Plus, if you finish it, you'll get a 10% discount on merch at the Max Fun store. Max Fun shows have always relied on support from our members and always will. This survey will help keep the few ads we do run interesting and relevant to you. That's MaximumFun.org/adsurvey. ADSURVEY. All one word. And thanks for your help.
Soylent, the original food tech company, makes delicious and nutritious nutrition products in convenient formats. I gotta say, I'm a fan of the Soylent Complete Energy. It is a very handy drink that you can take with you. You know, keep it in the bottle, have it when you're ready to have it. And it's not your usual kind of energy drink. It's not just going to get you all, you know, jacked up on whatever the, you know, over-the-counter speed they put in those things. It is the first complete nutrition nootropic shake to fuel your mind and body. Formulated with a proprietary blend of B vitamins, caffeine, L-theanine, L-tyrosine, and alpha-GPC, plus 15 grams of plant-based protein and 39 essential nutrients. It's a delicious way to keep you going throughout the day without the highs and lows you get from sugar.
Yeah, and you know your boy likes to get swole, so that complete protein is great. It's deliciously rich and creamy, and of course plant-based. That's a high protein. It has 30 grams of complete plant-based protein with 39 essential nutrients and 0 grams of total sugars, so you're not going to be packing on the pounds that you're burning off in the gym. Okay.
Yes, protein for all of us bodybuilders like me or like my more amateur friend Iffy. Yeah, I really like these. Their products are really quick. They're easy. There's no cooking, which is a real Drea Clark selling point. And I also really like the chocolatey taste of them because, again, that's a real Drea Clark selling point. They're very rich and creamy. And then I, like you guys know, I love to read all the nutrients in them. Like I take a sip and then I'm like, ooh, what does this have? Biotin? What am I drinking? Oh, zinc? How exciting.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. And yeah, just like you said, I like the quickness of it all. I'm always on the go. I'm always behind schedule. So, you know, there's no time needed. You just crack it open and you just gulp. So if you want to gulp, go to Soylent.com/MaxFilm and use promo code MaxFilm to get 20% off your first order. That's Soylent.com/MaxFilm and promo code MaxFilm for 20% off your first order. Drink up. Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Iffy Wideaway. In the studio with me are
Alonso Duralde.
I've got horniness in my genetic code, Moshe Kasher.
Drea Clark.
And today we have an email from the hotline. This one is from Laura Darling. Back in the day, I was a youth minister, and each summer I would host a film festival with films that I hoped would intrigue the teens in my youth group. One year I showed one of the Michael Apted Ups films. It did not go well. I vividly remember how one of the kids said kindly, "No offense, it's just not for me. I prefer a film with a plot and characters and stuff." However, another time I took several middle schoolers to see a Harold Lloyd film, Safety Last, and they absolutely loved it. So my question is, what are some of your film festival or personal recommendation successes and failures that took you by surprise?
First off, Alonzo just died a little listening to thinking of a bunch of youth group kids watching Michael Apted movies and being like, I wish it had a character.
Yeah, I would have showed those kids, those kids Gummo. What does this bring out of you?
I'll say, I feel like the first story that came to mind, I might have already told you, which is just to put my entire family on blast, that the last vacation we did pre-panny, we were in the Midwest near a lake, and we had like Gidget, my mother had told me like, oh, we're gonna like find a movie we can all watch when I, so I like planned ahead. I brought a motion picture called Waiting for Guffman that I was like, this is like, this is a four quadrant success. I can only win. Two of them went to bed midway through. My like dad was like, it was pretty good. Like I honestly was pretty convinced I was adopted after that screening. It was so disappointing to me. Waiting for Guffman? Yeah. Like that should be an easy hit.
Look, I have an older brother who is a giant fan of Catherine Deneuve. Like went to see Indochine in the theater. Like, it's just very much all about her. So I think so when they did a restoration in the 90s of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, I was like, oh, I'm going to send him this VHS cassette, and you know that he's just going to love it, because like this is like one of her first films, and she's so beautiful, and it's such a haunting, beautiful film. And actually, R.I.P. Nino Castanova, her co-star in the film, who also passed away this week. And yeah, he and his wife hated it. And I was like, really? The Umbrellas of Cherbourg? How do you love Catherine Deneuve and not be all over that movie? And apparently somehow
he should have turned the subtitles
off.
That
might have been that would have been the secret, I think.
Totally.
Mine is like, you know, she loved it, but when I took my mom to see Moonlight, you know, she overall enjoyed the film. But during the beach scene, very loudly, in a actual theater, you remember back when we could go to those? During the beach scene, she was like, oh, no. And I'm like, Mom, yes, he's getting jerked off. Yes, people get jerked off, Mom.
Dude, Iffy, that's crazy, because your mom might have been sitting behind me when I saw Moonlight, because I swear to God, I watched that movie, and every gay thing that would happen in that movie, the whole time, a woman behind me would loudly like sigh and gasp and say like, oh my God. And by the second, third of the movie, I'm like, he's gay. This is a gay guy. Like, that's what this movie is about. Like, you can't still be shocked that gay shit is happening. And then when he finally beats up his bully, she cheered for him. She goes, well, it's about damn time. I'm like, but you were the problem this whole time.
You're the bully.
She was simultaneously like not into the gay stuff, but then like also rooting for him. It was like a very funny movie watching experience.
Yeah, no, I had a lady behind me like that when we went to see The Color Purple, the musical. And I'm like, it's The Color Purple. Did you not know the women were going to kiss? Like, come on.
Yeah. Oh, it was like a prudish, like, oh, like she didn't have, she just was like, she was like, I don't, and I quote my mom, you know, it's not, you know, I'm fine with the ladies. It's just two men. Y'all are so big. I'm like, yeah, that's why it's hot, Mom. That's why.
Two big ass dudes going at it. Primary message of the film.
Your mom wanted to be watching the sapphic desires in The Color Purple.
She wanted a question about this film thing. I've never seen the Up films, but don't you need to have watched all of them in order? Can you just watch one at random?
Ideally, I think you get more out of it if you watch them in order. But if you do hop in, like all the premise of the Up films is that every 7 years he touches base with the same people. He started when they were 7 years old, and every 7 years you sort of watch these kids get older and older and turn to adults and older than that. But I think each film incorporates a lot of footage from the previous movies. So even if you're walking into like 28 Up or 42 Up, not having seen the previous ones, it'll kind of walk you through what you need to know.
I just feel like there's no more film bully character that I can paint than the person that's like, this year we're watching 56 Up. Everybody, come on.
You've never met these people before, but you're going to love them.
Yeah. I'm guessing that she showed them the first one. Like, if these are, teenagers or whatever, and she's watching and she's showing them, it's a documentary about seven-year-olds. So maybe they were just
it's a black and white British movie and they weren't having it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you my film festival experience. I was doing stand-up at Wise Guys in Salt Lake the weekend of Sundance, and it was happening, and I was like, you know, feeling jealous because I was just doing like a club in town. I was like, I wish I would. But then they had some like satellite movies, and there was one at midnight, and I was like, well, you know what? I'm tired, but I'm here. I should just go see this movie. So I randomly walked to the one Sundance film that's playing in Salt Lake, not in Park City. I wait in line. I'm the last person to get in. I don't even know what I'm watching. And I ended up watching The Raid, the Indonesian high-rise action movie at midnight with the most like hyped audience ever, cheering and screaming. And it was just like, it could not have been further from being force-fed 56 Up by a high school film festival curator. It was so exciting. I felt so lucky. And I was just like, films are great.
The nice thing is when somebody comes to you with a recommendation of a thing that you just were like, you've already made up your mind about, or you've never heard of it, you just are not into it, and then it winds up being a delight. One of that happened to me this year. Matt Atchity, who's one of my co-hosts on Breakfast All Day, was like, you have to watch Riders of Justice.
Oh, it's so good.
And I was like, really? I mean, I hate the title and everything. The poster didn't look appealing. It just, everything about it just smacked of like movie I'm not going to be into. But he's like, no, you have to see it. And I'm so glad I listened to him because, yes, it's amazing. It's one of my favorite films this year. But, you know, sometimes all the things, everything that can pile up against a movie and just make you think, no, you have to sort of work past it and be delighted.
Riders of Justice ruled. I loved it. Yes.
Me too.
I don't even know that I've heard of it. So now I have two recommendations and Alonzo's friend. So two and a half.
Well, I'll round it out to three.
Yeah. Okay.
I recommend watching the film Coda with the subtitles on.
It'll be a whole new experience for you, Andrea.
Oh, thank you to everyone who has called or written in. If you'd like to leave a message on the hotline, please call 979-803-1664 or leave us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org.
And let me now say this. Let me jump in and not let you do your outro.
No, go ahead and do it.
If you like advice, emails, and calls, listen to my podcast, The Endless Honeymoon Podcast, because that's all we do. And it's not about film. It's about love. And isn't that the driving force of film anyway? Isn't that why we make these beautiful, epic koans? Coan?
Yeah.
I think that's a great combo.
You landed that.
Listen to this podcast, get horny, and then listen to yours and find out about love. It's the perfect combo.
Yes.
Let me take it in for a landing. Now it's time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Alonzo, why don't you start?
Oh, speaking of a landing, the musical Come From Away has been filmed and is dropping today on Apple TV Plus. It is a musical about 9/11. Which you might not think you would want to see a musical about 9/11, but this is about the town of Gander, Newfoundland, which is home to this gigantic airport that used to be the place where all the planes would refuel before flying transatlantic, and now is not used much at all. Well, on 9/11, when U.S. airspace closed down, 38 planes got rerouted, and suddenly a town of 9,000 people had 16,000 people because all of these travelers who had nowhere else to go had to disembark, and you know the locals had to find shelter and food and you know toiletries and clothes and everything else, and so a dozen very talented performers portray the townspeople, they portray the travelers, they go in and out of different characters, all on a stage set with it that has like one revolving stage, a handful of chairs and a couple of tables, and they bring this story amazingly to life. It's funny, it's moving, it's sad. I had heard about this show, but I'd never gotten to see it. But now it's on Apple TV Plus, so you can watch it there. And I very highly recommend it. Come From Away.
That sounds amazing. Amazing, and I've never heard of it. My staff pick is a film that is currently out theatrically. I mentioned it briefly, maybe when we talked about Bentonville Film Fest, because I programmed it there. But it is called Language Lessons. It is written and directed and starring Natalie Morales. And it is a straight up two-hander. I don't think you see another person. It's her and Mark Duplass. And the entire thing in a different scenario than Alonzo's, but the same idea of like a tight conceit that they're working within. It's almost all filmed as if you are, no, it is entirely yes. filmed as if you're looking at Zoom screens. However, it is not like many that I've seen because of the pandemic. It is that they are in different countries. She is a Spanish teacher. His boyfriend has bought him Spanish lessons, and they start a dialogue and relationship because of that. So you're getting like pieces of their real life and all of these things happen. And it is surprisingly engaging for something like that. It never grew old for me, the construct. And part of it is they have really just natural chemistry and lovely performances, and it's funny and sad, and those are both things that I enjoy in films. And I think Natalie is a great actress and a great filmmaker and someone to support. And Language Lessons, if it's playing near you now and you feel safe in the theater, check it out. And if it sounds appealing, keep an eye out for it. Will be released I'm sure sooner than later.
Hmm. All right, Mosh, what do you have for us?
Okay, well, I'll cheat and do two. Neither of them are very profound or Truffautian, which is what I usually like to watch.
Sure.
But they're both silly popcorn flicks, but when you're talking about
49 of- up.
That's right. We're talking about Riders of Justice, which was truly one of my favorite films of the year, too. I found that because Paul F. Tompkins tweeted, if you liked Nobody and violent movies like that, you'll like Riders of Justice. So I watched that. And so a less known, incredibly violent film that I will recommend to people is Brawl in Cell Block 9, which is Vince Vaughn's, dramatic, purely dramatic turn. And it is so violent and so over the top and really good. And I love it. And also, I just watched, speaking of guilty pleasures, I just watched Blood Red Sky on Netflix, which is it's a hijack film, and it's also like a horror movie, and it's also like it's Passenger 57 meets the vampire Interview with a Vampire. And I liked it. I liked every moment of it, even though it was corny and you kind of knew what was about to happen. I enjoyed it too.
That's a crazy ass pitch. Passenger 57 meets Interview with the Vampire. I'm taking that to Warner Brothers tomorrow.
And I'm rounding things out with it seems like it's more of an episode, but it feels like it's like a documentary. It's like an anthology thing. I forget the name of the series, but the Malice at the Palace doc is phenomenal. It'll make you angry. It'll give you the full insight, which like, and it's interesting because I've watched a lot of sports docs before, and usually it's like old sports before my time, but I remember watching that happen. I remember seeing Meta World Peace come to the Lakers and being like, oh, this guy's a whack job because he attacked the fans. And then when you see the footage, you're like, no, the fans attacked all of them, and it immediately turned racist. Like, it was like, now just that quick, like, it was immediately racist, and it was like, oh yeah, that's good. Untold Malice at the Palace. So it's the series Untold that does all these different sports doc, but it's really good. It's a pretty quick watch, and you know, they I mean, I love a doc that really has a nice quick theme, and they visually, it's actually really cool, like the things they do in the doc. So definitely give that a check out. And speaking of out, we're about to roll out. Thank you, Moshe, for being on the show. Anything Yay. You'd like to plug?
Yeah, it's just my podcast, the Endless Honeymoon podcast that I do with my wife, Natasha Leggero. We do live relationship counseling calls and then make fun of our callers. And then we have people calling with their deep, dark secrets. So you get to hear a lot of those as well. Come see me live if I ever come to your town again, if real stand-up comedy will ever exist again. And thank you guys. This has been a real blast, a pleasure.
Yeah, yeah.
Yay. Thanks for being here.
If you have a comment or a suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Maximum_Film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/Maximum Film, or send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is the Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is the new, illustrious, wonderful, dope, all around, love to see this guy, Kevin Ferguson. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.